We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're talking with Marjolaine Martin about why we should care about the prisoners of Azkaban. I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry and liturgical music at Ohio Dominican University, co-editor with Katie, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today we are talking with a fellow podcaster. And so, Emily, I thought I'd warm us up a little bit just by asking you, what keeps you podcasting in the Potterverse?
Katie, you and I both know that professional demands sometimes crowd the space that we have in our lives for podcasting. But I would say the cool people that we get to speak with on the podcast, sometimes from far-flung places, sometimes from around the corner, and just also being able to see you on the regular and get to have great in-depth conversations with you and with our guests. And so that's what keeps me going.
That's
pretty
much...
a lot fit in with your life. You have more kids than me.
Well... I don't know. Yeah, it's always a lot, even if whether you have one or five. I don't know, five would be a lot.
I'm the last of five, I'm sure my mom would say. But at a certain point, you know, when you have five, like, they just start taking care of themselves. Like, my sister taught me to read, and my brother taught me to drive. And, you know, like, so, yeah, so it's kind of efficient, you know, if you get enough of them.
Well, okay, sure. All right, I'll buy that. Yeah, there are lots of demands on a person's time. And you and I have been doing this a long time, Emily, and you start to wonder, like, how much new stuff can we do? And, you know, is it time for something different? And, of course, the world of Harry Potter used to be a nice refuge from politics. It's sort of not that anymore. But
from culture wars, really, you know, politics, maybe not never so much, but,
right.
but
no, that's
it was
true.
A nice relief from culture wars.
Yeah.
And now
culture
it's less so.
Right. And all of the great people, and I have a great excuse to talk to people at conferences and honestly, I don't think we've run out of things to talk about yet.
We're not even on the verge of that. Because every time we think we might be, then we have the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference in October, which gives us tons of new ideas and tons of new people and returning people to speak to about new things.
Yeah, I just continue to like this as my little doorway into the fandom. And so I think today's episode is a great example of a topic that we, you know, maybe don't look at as closely as we could, maybe a little bit of a side topic in some ways that actually might be really, really important. And the person who's
going to... It looms in the margins of the story world, literally.
Yes. The person who's going to help us to see what is going on with this topic is a fellow podcaster. So without further ado, I will introduce our guest today, Marjolaine Martin. Marjolaine is a longtime podcaster in the Wizarding World fandom. For several years, she hosted the podcast Aspic, a French academic Harry Potter podcast, much like ours, that has 7 years of episodes. She also appeared on Speak Beastie, and she has just started a new podcast, Multiplet, named after the French way of saying omnioculars, which I love that connection. That's super cool. Marjolaine studied anthropology at the School of Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences, which in France is EHESS, and currently works for the French Ministry of Justice. Emily and I first met Marjolaine at LeakyCon in Chicago. You remember that? And we were delighted to see her present on Azkaban and prison reform at the Harry Potter Academic Conference in the fall of 2025. Welcome to the show, Marjolaine.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and to see your face again and to talk to you. It's a pleasure.
I feel like we are, we're kin as Potter podcasters, across the pond, in a sort of way of
Yeah.
saying that. Tell us your Harry Potter story. When did you first encounter Harry Potter, and when did you decide it was worth taking seriously for academic study?
So I like to tell the story that the first time the books were presented by to me, it was by my mom, and I was like around 8 or 9. So it was right after the first books were published, and so from a 9 years old, looking at this book called in French Harry Potter à l'école des sorciers, which is a translation, a weird translation. Harry Potter at the Sorcerer's School. I thought it's for babies. I'm too advanced a reader for that. And so yeah, I was very smug and already a Ravenclaw at this age. And so I
Love
refused
that.
to read them because they were not serious enough. So that's a connection. And I think if they kept the original title, The Philosopher's Stone, I would not hesitate to read them right away, because at this age I just discovered what the Philosopher's Stone was, what alchemy was. I already knew Nicolas Flamel because I saw a show maybe a year before about that. So yeah, that's a shame that they
Yeah, I was the same kind of reader. Like, if it had some kind of really cool, like alchemy and sorcery and like things like that, I was so into it. But I didn't always like the school-ager stuff.
So yeah, I had to wait for the first movie to come out, and it was just after I turned 11, and so I discovered finally at the exact good age to receive my Hogwarts letter. So it finally worked out perfectly. I started reading just after seeing the first movie, and the last book came out on the year of my 17th birthday. So perfect timing.
You
But
are the
yeah,
Harry
it's
Potter generation.
exactly the Potter generation. I could not be a more perfect definition of this generation. So yeah, that's me. I grew up with it, and yeah. So later, I think it was when I was at Marseille, and I will talk about Marseille a bit later because it connects to our subject today too. But they had a pop philosophy week every year, and I don't remember the exact date, but it was the early 2010. They had a philosopher, Marianne Chaillon, who gave a presentation about philosophy in Harry Potter, and it was the first time I was like still a fan and still really passionate about Harry Potter, but it was the first time that I had a teacher talking about philosophy, about a very deep subject, and enlightened my reading with that, and making connection with what I learned at school about philosophy. And so yeah, that was the first click I had about I can and I was already studying anthropology at this time, so I think I made the connection at this time that I could apply my analysis of the world in Harry Potter. So a few years later that I started listening to, I think it was around the same time that Mogonet Academia started as a podcast around that time. And so I discovered this podcast too, and a few years later that's what inspired my podcast Aspic. So
Tell us more about Aspik. Why that title for the podcast?
It's again the French translation for I don't know what it is in English. It's the last diploma in Hogwarts.
Is it the newts?
Yes,
Okay. Newt, yeah.
yes, that's it. So newts in
Oh, cool.
yeah. So but we transform the letters to make it. It says the Academy of Sorcerers, an interesting and captivating podcast. So we made it another translation for that.
I love it.
But yeah, so creating Aspic was the reason why I joined La Gazette du Sorcier, so the French fan site, in 2018. And because I met a friend, Alex, who was already working with La Gazette du Sorcier, and we talked about our love for podcast and for deep analysis of the series, and we realized that we both had the same idea. So we thought, yeah, we need to start this podcast. So yeah, we did 7 years and 47 episodes. So we closed the academia this year, but we are really, really proud of what we did, and we really had the same approach that Portoversity. Every episode we had a guest to talk about their work with Porter studies, if they are scholars, and we also invite people who are not scholars but who would love to cross their expertise on one topic or their professional experience and how it make them read Harry Potter differently or view the Wizarding World differently and make connection between the two. We also had several episodes about the Harry Potter Academic Conference because after 2020, they opened the conference internationally, so we could follow it. It's not that they open intentionally, it's that they make it available online. So we could access the conference. And so, of course, we already had the podcast running, and we made a point every year to follow the conference and to see as many talk as we can, and to do an episode about it after that, to make it accessible for the French audience, because not everyone in France talk English and speak English, and we wanted to have French academics and French people who talk about to show that it's not only in the US or in the speaking in the English speaking world that there is a Potter study field, but we also wanted to bring this English studies to the French audience. So yeah,
I think that was one of the kind of unintended wonderful changes that came about during COVID times, where we sort of discovered that we could build more bridges with things like Zoom and, you know, all of the, you know, kind of digital ways that we can connect together. And it's so funny to hear you talk about Aspeak, because that just sounds exactly like what Emily and Lori and I do. I'm Potterverse. Yeah, you're exactly. Right. It's very similar. But now you're looking to do something a little different with Multiplet. So what's that? What's going on there?
It's a long time project because, of course, there is a lot of great rereading podcasts that go through the series chapter after chapter to reread it. I mean, my first experience in podcast was Allohomora, and that's what bring me into the Porter podcast world. And I listen to many other rereading podcasts, and maybe the last of them that was a big inspiration is Harry Potter After 2020 of Laurie Kim and JC, a big inspiration too. So we wanted to do, and there were already other, at least one other big rereading podcast in rereading Potter in podcast form in French, but it was more like Allohomora was at the beginning, so just rereading without any specific lens in which we reading the story. But we were looking for what lens what classes we want to put it on to reread the series. And with the HBO series coming up, we had this idea of adaptation, and the fact that they will do a new adaptation. We don't have to be only spectators of that and passive about that. We can think before that of, if we are choosing how to adapt the series today, what would be our choices, or what we cut, what we change, what we add. And with 20 years of discussion behind us, and this everything new that's happening around criticism around the series, and the world changed between the late 80s and the late 90s and today. So yeah, that's what we want to do, to rethink it with the... We think that some things need to be changed to for the series to be still relevant today, but but also we still love the series, and that's why we are still in the fandom despite all of it. And we still think that there is part of this story that is important to us and can be important to a new generation. So we also want to think about what we want to pass on to a new generation.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And I love the idea of the omnioculars or a multiplet as like being able to see, you know, in a wider view than maybe.
Sometimes wider, sometimes focused, sometimes rewind, sometimes,
I think when there is a reinterpretation, it offers all, exactly like what you're saying, it offers the current audience, even past, you know, people who've known it in the past, to look at it in a different way and to think about it afresh in ways that can be really fruitful and worthwhile. So what a cool idea.
That was my first reaction when they announced the TV show. I was like, why that? You could do anything else. You can expand the universe. Why doing the same story again? But, and I still think that's the worst idea they could have. But now that we know that we will have it, I'm thinking, I love reinterpretation of stories. I love the same stories like myth, like fairy tale being retold in all ages and all lenses. And so I'm not naive that it will not be absolutely new retelling of the story, and but that's a chance to rethink about it and to put our own rethinking of that.
I'm for it. I'm a little less excited about it since the trailer. I'm still gonna watch it, so I'm not joining another thing,
but
you
I
never
think
know.
One of the things we didn't like about the trailer, I don't know, Marjolaine, if you've seen the trailer, but was that it wasn't different enough. You know, it seemed a little bit just like, you know, repeat for TV.
Yeah, and the lack of magic also was, I found, to be disappointing. You know, it was
I'm letting them the benefits of the doubt on that, because it's a very early trailer, and all the after effects are probably not ready at the time that they release the trailer. So I'm thinking that's the reason why we don't have magic in this trailer.
That's a great point.
I agree with you. At first, I was like, the first images, I was like, oh, we see it's an HBO series. It's a very different in the dark mood of the Dursley ambience. But very soon we have the exact same shot that we had in the movies. So we'll see. We'll see how it
goes. And maybe they'll get bolder with it as it goes along. And if they feel that they have permission to do things a little bit differently, right, if the audience responds well. I was thinking about how, you know, the first book in the series, you know, the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, it's pretty formulaic children's book, right? But then the later ones actually they're much different, and they're able to go in their own direction. And so maybe we can have the hope that the HBO series will, if it starts a little bit like the movies redux, maybe it'll grow out of that a little bit.
We'll continue to have a lot to talk about both here and in your world of your new podcast. So, but we actually really wanted to chat with you today about your presentation last October of 25 at the Harry Potter Academic Conference on Prisons in the Wizarding World, Symptoms of Failing Democracy, which was based somewhat on the experience you've gained working for the French Ministry of Justice at the Research Office of the Directorate of Prison Administration, which is a mouthful. How did that experience help you think more deeply about prisons in the Wizarding World, and especially, of course, our prime example of Azkaban?
Yeah, so I tend to analyze a lot of things through pop culture. That's my thing. And on the other side, I almost always also analyze pop culture to give it always a political meaning or a way to think about societal subject. And but I must admit, I never really thought about prison before joining the administration. And when I was approached for this job, my first reaction was fear. And I was like, Am I ready for this? Am I ready to think about prison every day? I'm not sure. And of course, I think that reaction was also because all I knew about prison was mostly tainted by pop culture and by what I know about it through fiction. So I rethought about that later, but I thought it would be a unique chance to discover this world that I don't know anything about, and also how a ministry work from the inside. And I'm realizing that I also have a lot to say about the Ministry of Magic in comparison of my own experience. But yeah, that's another subject. But yes, and we are entering an election year next year, so yeah, I will have a lot of weird crossing analysis about what's happening. But yeah, in Aspic, we already at this point had many friends on the podcast discussing Harry Potter through the lens of their professional experience. So we had teachers judging Hogwarts system. We had media professional talking about journalism in the wizarding world. We had healthcare professional talking about medicine in the wizarding world. So of course, I already was ready to have something to talk about my own experience. So I very soon thought about Azkaban and thought about my own view about what prison is and how I rediscover what it is and the history of it, because I have a colleague who is an incredible historian, and I love to work with him, looking at archive and learning about the past and how it informed what it is now. So
Yeah, you're really
it's
speaking my language with the kind of history of the prisons, and that's one of the things I really liked about your presentation for sure. And so kind of help us to see what are some of the not only historical but also literary predecessors of Azkaban or influences on Azkaban.
In the name itself, I think every reader was, and the fact that it's a prison on an island, we were supposed to think about Alcatraz. It's in the name. But for me, and probably because I'm French, Azkaban is more a reference of many, many places we have in France, but probably elsewhere in Europe, of old fortress or abbey who were turned into prisons. And I'm telling you, if you are visiting a historic building from the Middle Ages in France, the chance it was used as a prison at some point between the late 18th century and the early 20th century is very high, because we turn everything into prisons. Not anymore, but there is very few prison who are still this past of being old fortress. But yeah, it's. I mean, we closed a big prison last year who was an abbey before that. So,
Yeah, so
but
and
I.
Azkaban was also a fortress, right? An
Yes.
island fortress.
Yeah, it was a fortress a private fortress from the 15th century. So we will talk about that later, because what it was, it's connected to other subjects, I think. But yeah, it was a fortress that was turned into a prison. And like I said earlier, I lived in Marseille for 9 years, and on my horizon in Marseille, there was the Château d'If, and I was used to have a fortress on the horizon on the sea that was made famous by Alexandre Dumas in its novel Le Comte de Monte Cristo, and its movie adaptation, where the main character, Edmond Dantès, is unjustly in prison. It's in its early 20s and escaped from after 14 years, nearly going mad in horrible conditions in prison to seek vengeance and swimming through the sea to escape. So I knew this story, and I have this vision, literary vision, but it was also based on real fact that the Château d'If was a military fort that was turned into a political prison after that. But I can't believe that it took me so long to realize the similarities between Edmond Dantès and Sirius Black. I mean,
Yeah,
I
like
didn't realize it
wow.
until reviewing I don't know if it blew past me. I am a huge fan of that book, Count of Monte Cristo, but I kind of forgot how much I loved it until there was a very recent adaptation
on, I think it was Masterpiece, UK-based production. And it was a really great, like, 6 or 8 part adaptation. And I just watched it a couple of months ago. So I was thrilled to think about Edmund and Sirius and the parallels between them. And I can't believe it didn't hit me before that. But yeah, it's a great parallel.
I don't recall any way that the author talked about that, but I don't know if it's just us.
But she's well read. Yeah. She's read a lot of stuff.
Probably. As if she didn't read that page turner.
Yeah. So what's the significance of prisons that used to be fortresses? Like, how do you think that shapes, you know, what the prison is, how it's seen, and you know the way people think about it and maybe live within it?
Yeah, so at first we have to think about why, and of course it was just a pragmatic thing to turn these places into prisons. Prison as we know it today, it's quite recent, so it just started at the late 18th, early 19th century. So suddenly they had a lot of need for places to put prisoners in it. Before that, there were only prison like Le Château d'If or like other one like La Bastille in Paris, where you put political opponent. So we already had this idea of prison like fortress, where we put people that the power doesn't want and want to put far away. The specific of having a prison on an island in the sea, just somewhere that it would be hard to break out from. So, yeah.
It's kind of exile. I mean, you had been talking about how in the, you know, the history of prisons, and I always have to tell students this too, like prison wasn't the punishment. Prison was where you waited for your justice to happen. And the punishment was usually something corporal, right? Or if not, you know, death itself. But that, you know, when the prison system develops as its own form of punishment, I mean, it strikes me that when you're, you know, being put in a what used to be a fortress on an island, that it is a kind of punitive exile that is being enacted on you.
Yeah, what you just talked about, it's really what I didn't used to think about, the fact that prison was so recent. And before that, like you said, it was just a cell where you were waiting for your sentence, which was physical pain. And I never realized, because in French, prison sentence is called peine. And a peine is a sentence. A peine is the same word as pain. And it's exactly the same word. Peine mean pain, mean sorrow, mean everything. So you have to suffer. And even with the change, with the modern world, with prison, that it's not supposed to be pain. Prison is to suppress the physical sentence, the fact to be put in pillory, to be cut a finger, or I don't know. It's a new form of punishment. Today, it's not supposed to be pain to be put in prison, but we still have this heritage of we still think about being put in prison. A synonym of experiencing pain. We didn't truly pass through this original thing that to pay for a crime, you have to be in pain.
And the suffering is a part of what you're supposed to experience there. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people. And I think, you know, one of the things that you talk about is when it's kind of tough to reform, to do prison reform, because people, they want it to be kind of suffering. And if bad stuff's going on, well, you shouldn't have committed the crime, you know? That can be a way to dismiss reform.
Yeah, I'm positive I just heard a politician on the news within the last 2 days say, well, this is not supposed to be. And they, in fact, they were not even referring to like traditional prisoners, but people who are being held for coming into the country illegally. And so they're talking about, well, it's
the
not
detention
supposed to be
centers.
Detention centers, exactly. And where they're serving food that is rancid, and people are getting sick from rancid milk, and people
and
are
they can't get medical attention.
And they can't get medical attention. And a politician was asked about it, and he said, well, you know, they've all, everyone in here has committed a crime, which is debatable. And so it's not supposed to be a party in there, you know. And it's like, yeah, actually, I think the punishment is just the lack of your liberty. It's not actually, you're not actually supposed to be treated cruelly, you know. And even then, they haven't had due process. So, like, these people, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. It's a whole thing. But, yeah.
Right.
The way we think about the role of prison is to pay for a crime, but also to restore society and to make society safer. So, of course, making society safer is to put dangerous people away. That's a way to do it. Because most people, I mean, it's just a small percentage that spend the rest of their life in prison. Most people who go to prison will go out at some point. So the role of prison is to restore this person. Then when it come out, it will not commit a crime again. And so the prison is supposed to care for the people, to prevent another crime to be committed, and to make the society safer by healing it at some point, but
reforming the individual, you know. Yes. instead of just punishing. And of course the wizarding, of course Azkaban with its staff of dementors is really a comment on you know, the actual the lack of achievement of just what you're talking about reformation. Yeah. of you know, criminal
and care.
Individuals
and care.
Right, and care.
Even,
it's like, it's basically
name, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Putting it right out there to say, this is, we're doing the opposite here. We will mm-hmm. release you when you are a shell of a mm-hmm. of a human being, instead of, you know, somebody with.
And literally, if you get the Dementor's kiss, you've been rendered soulless.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit more about Azkaban, Marjolaine, and the sort of, you know, the history, purpose, you know, the backstory of Azkaban. I think a lot of times we don't really yeah. get that, you know, in the books themselves. So what did you find out about it?
So we actually had an origin story of Azkaban in Pottermore. And it says that it was originally a fortress built by a dark wizard named Ecrisdis, and in the 15th century, and he used this fortress to be secluded and to do dark magic, dark stuff, and also to torture muggles and the poor fishermen going through that, and he was luring them in the fortress and doing bad stuff to them. So the interesting thing is that the Dementors are a manifestation of all the dark past of this fortress, like the dark magic, like infused the wall and the walls, and the Dementors just popped from the despair of the place. And it's also in the name Azkaban in Pottermore. It says that of course it's a mixture of Alcatraz, but also Abaddon, which Rowling says the Hebrew word meaning place of destruction or depths of hell. And so it's really this idea of, before even being a prison, it was that. It was this this place where the fortress have seen so many dark stuff that the Dementors appeared. And I think the Dementors are only coming from there. I don't think we have an example of Dementors appearing or being birthed at another place. I'm not sure, but yeah. So the fact that the Ministry used this place to turn it into a prison is a mistake, but also quite opportunistic and capitalistic choice, because they have this place, they have free labor with the Dementors being already there. They are perfect guards for them, because of course when you are in presence of a Dementor, you don't even have the will to escape. So perfect security guards.
Cost effective. The Dementors yeah. are paid through the suffering of the prisoners. So it kind of it's an engine that runs itself.
Yeah, but it made me think also because, of course, the Dementors are a very extreme version of what we think about when we think about prison guards. And but it made me think about, yeah, how we see prison guards. And in fiction, they're always depicted like cold and cruel individual because who would choose to be there because that well, okay, that's their job, but they choose to do their job and they're not prisoners, they choose to be there, so they must be evil in their mind to choose to be in this awful place. But of course in reality it's different. But I was also thinking about how living every day in a place of pain, a place of despair can affect you. Even the prison guards, and as I know, mental health for prison guards is a big subject, and how living in this place that is not fun, it's affecting you. And I was thinking about that with the Dementors' idea of being created by just the place having seen so much stuff, so. It's bad that we think of the prison guard as Dementors, but it's also telling something about the effect of being somewhere that where people are suffering every day. Just want to add that prison guard. Oh, of course, they have the mission of keeping the prisoners inside and preventing the breakout, but they also have a mission of what I said earlier, that they have to take care of the individual, and they have a role in helping a prisoner to make sense of their sentence and to become better person. And if you they have a central role into because they when you are in prison, you lost freedom, you lost your liberty to work and to go elsewhere, but you should not lose your dignity. And that's responsibility of the prison guard to prevent that, to let the prisoners keep their human dignity. And that's not an easy task because
No.
they are not easy individuals that you are facing with. So, yeah.
Right. And I teach our first year seminar on, it's called What Does It Mean to Be Human? And we spend the first few weeks of the class talking about a liberal arts education and what it is and what they've signed up for. And we talk about the quality of freedom. We read John Henry Newman, and we talk about freedom. And I'm starting, our conversation's starting to just make me wonder if there is a way to deprive somebody of their freedom without, doing serious damage to their human dignity. If those two things, if it's possible to separate those two things and to say, I think my rational mind says, yes, of course it is, but then there's part of me that's like, oh, there's just something dehumanizing about losing your freedom. And of course I know, this says nothing about the crimes these people committed, right?
You're losing your freedom in one way, but I mean, I definitely believe in the freedom of the mind and
Yes.
spirit, even when your body is in prison, and that there's a way in which you can have dignity and behave with dignity and retain your dignity even when you are imprisoned, so long as your mind continues to be free. I mean, maybe there's something there. Although
Yeah.
I think one of the things about Azkaban is that their minds are not free.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the effect of the Dementors. And that's what is striking for me, thinking about Azkaban compared to what I saw in prison is in prison as I saw it's more the environment, it's more the building that is quite intimidating, and the fact that you are crossing so many doors, and the noises and the strict rules that you have to follow, and it's in of course the how the cell look like, and it's depressing by itself. But in Azkaban, of course, there is this scary fortress, but it's the Dementors that are the most scary thing. And in prison, it shouldn't be the prison guard. It's the human factor is what is supposed to keep the prisoners linked to society, and and it's also the fact that they have visits. They are supposed to maintain this connection with society. They are not supposed to be completely cut from society. To completely isolate the prisoner is an archaic way of prison. Is what we were what we were doing at some point, but since then we realized that maybe not the best way to reintegrate people afterwards in good condition to be able to be good citizen again. But in Azkaban, they don't have any human connection. Is what is the most frightening for me.
Yeah, and I think that
I'd hang out as a dog as well. Like, serious. I think I'd just transform into a dog and just sit there just thinking dog thoughts.
Well, I mean, he remains free of mind, right? So
right.
Yeah. And I do think, like, prison reform, starting in the, like, 19th century, but maybe not so much until the 20th century, we do get people realizing that it's not just about, like, revenge on the person who did a crime like, punishment pen, as you said, but also that it's supposed to actually create some sort of social benefit ultimately. And so when you do that, that sort of reminds you, you have to care for the person, even if they're guilty, which we know that there are people in prisons mm-hmm. who are actually not guilty of the crimes that they're there for. So one of the central questions that your presentation addressed was the relationship between democracies and the prison systems that democracies develop. And what do you see as the relationship between these two? We've talked a little bit about freedom and prisons, but what's the relationship between a prison system and the democracy in which it exists?
I was struck by the first director I had in the administration. And in one of his speech, he talked about prison administration being the sweep vehicle of society. Like, we have to take care of all the failures of our society. Because if you end up in prison, it's not because you failed, it's because society failed. And I was like, wow, yeah, it changed the view on the role of prison and also the role of society as a whole toward the prison. Is we need to prevent people to go to prison because, like you said, Emily, I think in the idealistic society, we should only need prison for a very small percentage of individuals that are too dangerous. But the people who are too dangerous to be outside, it's nothing compared to the hundreds of millions of people that are in prison today. And so the fact that we have so many people in prison, we should not think that as a we don't have enough prison. That's what I hear in France now, because we have a huge problem of overcrowded prison. And I talk about that last October. It's even worse today, and it's horrible. And the only political answer is we need to build more prison more quickly. And like, but that's not how we fix the problem. And having overcrowded prison is a failure of society because we don't see another answer to our problem, the society problem, than to send people to prison. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is what tools prison has to do its job to help prisoner to reintegrate into society and not return it to prison a few months later. So, yeah, that's the two things that are a good symptom of not just how the prison work, but how society work. And if there is a problem in prison, we can be sure that there is a problem in society in some point. Even it can be about social inequality. When we enter in prison and we see how poverty is overrepresented into the prisoner, we have to think, what are we doing? Are we criminalizing poverty? That's a real question that we have to ask. And also, it works for every crime that end up in prison. Like, it's always an answer to a failure of something that we didn't manage to prevent.
What about capitalism? We've touched on capitalism and the role it plays. How does it play a role in our or the Wizarding World's or both reluctance to engage in thoughtful prison reform?
Yeah, because it's expensive to do prison reform. That's the short answer. But like I said, why the Ministry of Magic chose Azkaban as a prison is really because they didn't want to put effort into. I don't even know if it's a question in the Wizarding World because they never talk about money really much. But they didn't want to put the effort and probably the fund to create a new place, take the time and the effort to think about how to change, how to make something that will take care of society as a whole. And that's the same with in our Muggle world. We are, like I said earlier, we are stuck in a system that we tried to change, but we are still stuck in old way of thinking about it. And it created the problem that we have now. But to solve this problem, it takes time and more than time, money, because having too many prisoners at some point, you have to really have the funds to take care of every prisoner correctly and not just open a new prison to put them in it. You have to have all these professionals that are working with the prisoners to help them go back to society, to help them correct their behaviors or to work on what led them to prison. If it's poverty, if it's you have to have the funds to fix that and to help the people reintegrate and not go back to prison. We don't see in the Wizarding World that's the main problem, because we see that in Azkaban they mostly send. It's a bit weird the way justice work in the Wizarding World, because we don't know what they do with lesser crime. The only example we have is Mundigus Fletcher, who is not a dark wizard, but who went to Azkaban at some point for a short period of time. But it's like they all put everyone in a prison that was think for the worst dark wizard that we need to keep heavily secluded and heavily guarded.
I'm sure they said they were being tough on crime. It's a way of talking that, you know, it sounds tough. It sounds dominant. And I always think too about how, you know, prison systems are a function of the capitalist world, and that they take funds and they have to also generate funds. And there's also been privatization of prisons. And that's one of the things when these mm-hmm. immigrant detention centers that I very much worry about. And their goal is not to reduce the prison population, as you were saying before, because then they'd be out of a job. They need more prisoners coming in. They need more prisons. Like, that's the nature of capitalism, is the bigoting and bigoting, as the Lorax story says of Dr. Seuss. That just strikes me as really dangerous in a democracy, when really, you know, the goal is to recognize the individual dignity and equality of all people. And as you said, that prisons themselves become really a symptom of the failures of your democratic society in providing for all of its members and preventing bad things from going on, or crimes. And that you lose sight of that when you're just about the punishment. And I was thinking about with the Dementors, like for the Wizarding World, like this is a way to keep the Dementors kind of in check and working with the government and sort of satisfying them in a way that I think is to the benefit of the ministry, but in a way that's really corrupt.
That's also the lesson of the stories of Harry Potter, is that at some point you lose control of these Dementors, and they don't respect the government because they don't have any other agenda than to feed on the despair of people. So I don't know if we can draw a line between that and capitalism, but
that's not exactly the same.
Not exactly, but yeah, but that's I mean, you think that it's the best way to keep the society safe to have dementors, or to have huge prison, or to put four people in a 2 people cell, or I don't know. It has to, at some point, you and even the people working the prison are saying, we can't do our job if you keep sending people in, more people than we can work with, and it's not safe anymore. And at some point, it breaks, and that's what we see in Azkaban with the big breakout, because they didn't took seriously the risk of dementors being the guards and having every dark wizard in the same prison. I don't know.
Maybe not the best
yeah.
idea.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah,
Seems iffy.
we have this problem right now in France with a new great idea of putting all the worst criminals in this high security prison, new high security prison. I'm like, well, maybe I should talk about Azkaban a bit more,
Yeah.
because that's weird to think about that as being the greatest idea. But
So, Marshalyn, you also talked about your paper with the Ministry of Justice that you work for, and I was just curious, how did they respond to your discussion of Azkaban and the kind of history of prisons and also the notion of prison reform?
yeah, it was funny, because it was really the collide of every word because yeah, talking about prison in my podcast was something fun to do, but also very important for me, because I didn't know nothing about prison before working there, and I discovered, I don't know if it's a passion, but I really care about my job, and I really care about what I can do. And so doing this podcast was also a way of having a bit more liberty into what I can say, and trying also to have another medium to interest more people about prison and about what's happening. And so when I told my colleagues that I have done this podcast, and they were very interesting to listen to it, my immediate colleagues in the research office. And so they told me to put it on the publication that I am doing for the administration, to tell everyone about the research news, the research actuality, the new research that are out. And we did a little few words about the podcast, and a lot of people noticed it, and it was just few lines on the bottom of the, because I was not comfortable about saying to everyone, yeah, I'm talking about my job, connecting it to Harry Potter. It's fun, and yeah, it's not something that is
Yeah, you want it to,
it's
it
a bit
sounds
weird, so
serious. I mean, it's a serious topic, and sometimes people
yeah.
think if it's Harry Potter, it can't be serious, but like obviously it is, Yeah.
Everyone who listened to it from the ministry, they thought, yeah, it was really interesting to make what we talk about every day more accessible to a large audience, and so I was even invited by another office to talk specifically of how I did this podcast, and if it's a way that we can it's a way that we can explore more to interest a large audience on our subject, because, and that's also why it's so hard to do prison reform, is the thing that we are talking about since the beginning, is that nobody want to talk about it, and nobody want to think about it. It's very hard to a politic to carry a prison reform and to make it popular in the opinion, because you have to spend money on it, and you have to make choices that most people will not understand, because they are stuck in the in what they are fed since childhood about what prison should be, and most people will not take the time to try to understand how we need to treat bad people like prisoner, because yeah, they are not it's not easy to extend your empathy to people who did really bad things, and it's not the easiest thing to do, and it's not something that we want to think about it. So
your point there is really excellent. I think sometimes people can think, oh yeah, I can imagine that maybe I could be poor and that would be hard, and so I can think about, you know, ways that we could address income inequality. Although I think that is, like you said, poverty is also criminalized in the Western world in a lot of ways. But then to say, well, but I'm never going to be a bad person who'll go to prison. I'm not a criminal, right? I'm not. And so I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to worry about it. And, you know, this is, Emily, this is more your territory, but we've had some politicians, you know, talking a lot about, and I guess public figures is maybe what I more want to say, you know, sort of bringing back in the idea of a different way of thinking about like Christian politics than what's currently being practiced in the United States, but emphasizing like the Beatitudes and also Jesus saying his, like when he said to his followers, you know, when I was hungry, you fed me, right? That whole line. But people leave out, they always leave out, when I was a prisoner, you visited me, because they don't want to say that publicly, even when they're actually promoting the same ideas. And I think it's because of exactly what you're saying, that it's hard for people to extend their empathy to the prisoner. But when I was a prisoner, you visited me. And of course, Jesus was imprisoned by the state.
Right. Capital punishment. Yeah, I had a lady, we were singing a song, preparing music for Mass years ago, and we were singing a song that was based on some text from Isaiah, and it said, you know, the Lord sets captives free. And she balked in rehearsal. She said, I'm not singing that line. I'm not singing that line.
Wow.
I don't want prisoners set free. I don't want prisoners set free. And I was like, oh, it's a stumbling block. Look at that. You know, but yeah, that's absolutely right. And so it's hard to get people interested in prison reform and in making prisons a better place, not only for prisoners, but for society.
Right.
Because you have the least sympathetic, you know, direct beneficiaries. Right. And I think that's probably why it's so hard to talk about education reform as well, is because as much as we say we care about our children, we don't take the sort of actions that, you know, that bring that value to light.
Right. But both are really vital to a democratic society.
Yes.
Yeah. And the two have the same objective, to make the society better and to safer and more. Yeah. Because, of course, if you invest into education, you will also solve some of the problem that lead people to prison. And if you invest into prison, you can create persons that will make good change for society. And so, yeah, that's, it seems simple when you think about it like that, like, making the prison better, it will help the prisoner be better person when they come out, and it's beneficial to everyone to feel safer knowing that the prison do its job to keep dangerous people in and to help people being less dangerous when they go out. But yeah, that's that implies a lot of baggage and a lot of heritage that not every country are equal facing that, because even in Europe we have neighbors not that far away that are doing a far better job than we are in that north of Europe mostly. But of course they have less people than we have. but yeah, that's not an excuse.
Well, thank you so much, Marjolaine, for what a great conversation. I just feel like I learned even more than from watching your presentation, and it's just been delightful to talk with you today.
Thank you.
I thought that I would end with something that reflects some of the seriousness of what we've been talking about today. So let's end with Hagrid's reflections on being held in Azkaban. from book three, The Prisoner of Azkaban, which doesn't actually refer to Hagrid, but Sirius, as we've talked about. But Hagrid was imprisoned in book two, and the trio finally ask him about it in book three. After a pause, Hermione said timidly, "Is it awful in there, Hagrid?" "You've no idea," said Hagrid quietly. "Never been anywhere like it. Thought I was going mad. Kept going over horrible stuff in me mind. The day I got expelled from Hogwarts. Day my dad died. Day I had to let Norbert go." His eyes filled with tears. Norbert was the baby dragon Hagrid had once won in a game of cards. "You can't really remember who you are after a while. And you can't see the point of living at all. I used to hope I'd just die in my sleep. When they let me out, it was like being born again. Everything came flooding back. It was the best feeling in the world. Mind, the Dementors weren't keen on letting me go." I think that's definitely worth paying attention to and asking, is this what justice looks like? So watch out for the Dementors, everyone, and have some chocolate. It'll help. Until next time, class dismissed. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.